Richard Skipper celebrates. Every show is a celebration. Each show, Richard delivers the artists you love, showcasing what makes them unique. Never gossipy. The antidote to a sometimes hectic world. Now, here's your host, Richard Skipper.
Happy Wednesday, everyone, and welcome to Richard Skipper Celebrates. If you're watching this live, it is Wednesday. The Christmas tree is being lit tonight in Rockefeller Center here in New York, but we've been asked to stay away. The best way to watch it is on television, as I will be watching it tonight. And I am so thrilled that you're all here today, because I think we are in for a very exciting ride for the next hour. My guest today is Maggie Casella. And Maggie and I are actually physically meeting, well, not physically in person, but virtually meeting for the very first time today. But I've been reading all about her, and I've been very, very exciting to learn about the trajectory of her career and life and the incredible things that she's done, and a very circuitous route to show business. And yet when she got here, she managed and very successfully to put her hand in every pot. And she, in addition to everything else that she does, she's a juggler, because she juggles so many things in her life. And Maggie, I'm thrilled that you're
boobs.
Here today.
Boobs. Yes. I juggle boobs.
Well, I'm glad that you're here. And before we start, I want to ask you, in the midst of this crazy world that we find ourselves in, how are you doing really? And I know, and I want to tell everyone else, if you don't mind, in addition to being here today, she's been moving. You are the third guest that I've had on this show who was in the process of moving when we did the show live.
So what does that tell you? I mean, I think it says something about where we are. I turned off my stupid, messages, but they keep coming in for some reason. I think it tells you where we are in the whole COVID thing. Some people cope with it in different ways, and some people don't cope with it very well. And that's understandable, because there's isolation, especially if you're a member of the queer community, and there's, or any marginalized community really. Mm-hmm. And that's hard, because geez, I remember when I first came out when I was 17, just a few years ago. And there was no place really, there was no internet. We didn't have email. So I went out every single night. When I was 17, I went to the bar every single night, because I couldn't believe it. I was like, here's community. This is who I am. And this is the place for me to go. So I came home from work and I turned it around. And I, every night, Richard, I mean, Tuesday night, there's no one at the gay bar on Tuesday night in New Haven, Connecticut. Called Partners, which I think is still there, which is kind of bananas. But
our mutual friend Rosa Puzo, brought you to me, she's watching, so she'll let us know if it still exists or not there.
I think the last time I was there, I drove by it. Whether it's open or not, I don't know. But I mean, so I think there's a certain amount of, get her done. It's a project. It allows you to be cut off from everything. Moving is an excuse that everyone accepts. I can't do that. I'm moving. my friend Jenny McNulty, I'm doing an interview with her today at 4:00. Like, she asked me, to do this interview like 5 or 6 or 7 times. And I kept saying no. And I'm like, this girl's going to think it's her, but I'm like, I'm moving. And really it was about, trying to organize
my
life.
Tells us the bar is still there. So,
there you go. Partners is still there. Pretty great. I think moving in the midst of a pandemic is actually a project that makes you feel like you're not languishing. You're literally and figuratively moving forward. Everybody accepts, I can't get anything done as an excuse, moving as an excuse for I can't get anything done. So all those projects that I'm supposed to be doing, the writing, the We're Funny That Way website, all of those things, they get to get put on pause because I'm moving. Mm-hmm. Of course, I'm fooling other people, but I'm not fooling myself. In my head, I'm like, you have to get the website done, and why aren't you writing that thing? And so there's that. But, that's like why I think three of your people are moving, because we can. And also a lot of people are just bailing from their other lives. Like, you know, I lived in the city for the last 20 something years and I grew up in the country. My wife. City,
when you say the city, what city are you referring to?
Toronto. I'm in Toronto. Okay. So I lived in the city in Toronto for the last 25 years. And I was, you know, I grew up in the country, and my wife actually, her father was in the military. So she was a military brat, and there's an Air Force base here. And she spent, a portion of her childhood, right, 20 minutes from here on the military base. So was like, oh, why not? So we did. And, you know, there's the.
Well, there's, you know, what's the experience like? You know, I've been here with my husband, for going on 31 years. I can't even imagine, you know, at this point, moving to another location. I just can't. You know, what is that experience like after 20 years of being in one spot?
Well, I mean, I wasn't in the same house. I was in the last house, same house for 16 years. But interestingly enough, I've been caring for my parents from afar. My mom passed in March at 96. So they were 96 and 98, and my dad's now 99.
God bless
and
him.
Yeah. My mom was with it right to the end. So that was, you know, amazing. I was very lucky. And they had said we were never going to leave the house. Italians, right? We're going to stay here. We're not moving, you know, whatever. And then my mom just had this thing. She looked at me, she said, Margaret, and no one calls me Margaret but my mom, and she is no longer here. So anyone on this earth who calls me Margaret but my mom, okay, my dad, but he doesn't call me that, I will punch you in the throat. So don't call me Margaret.
Let me ask you that. What is the aversion to the name Margaret?
I like, it's just, it's when I was in trouble. It was like, Margaret Mary. You know what I mean?
Oh, okay.
We don't. And I'm not a Margaret. In grade two, my Mrs. Sixman, my grade two teacher, looked at me and said, no, you're Maggie. And that was it. I don't read Margaret. I don't, you know, I did have to use it when I was a lawyer. I had to say Margaret a lot. So, you know, for the, I had to use it, which I always choked on it. Anyhow, sidestep back on, because my attention surplus disorder just kicked in and I went somewhere else, but I also can get right back to where
I'm
going.
I'm right there with you.
Yeah. Okay. So, you know, my mom just looked at me one day and said, Margaret, I can't spend another winter here. I'll lose my mind. I'll get depressed. I want to go to the museums. And this was at 94 or something, you know, or 93. I want to go to the museums. I want to go to the symphony. I want to be around people. And because they were in the country. And she said, your father can sleep in a chair anywhere. So that was that. So when I moved them, they had been in the same home for 50 years. And they're depression era survivors of the first depression. And of course, nothing got thrown out. And things, you know, if it broke, you could have the part, you might need the parts. All of it was in the basement. So I cleaned out 50 years of stuff. And after that, Richard, I came home and I was like, yeah, no, there's nobody to clean up after us. And I really don't want, like, you know, the nieces and nephews sort of going, what the F is this? And why did they keep it? And the beautiful part about cleaning my folks' house out while they were alive was I got to pick up stuff and then call them or go to where they were living and say, why would you keep this? You know, so that was the pleasure of that. A lot of people don't have that pleasure.
You know, I was reading somewhere recently that there's a book out, and it is a book that you fill out while you've got all your faculties about where everything is, what needs to be done when you pass away. You know, moving on, transitioning, dying is very much a part of our lives. And yet it's something that all of us want to avoid.
Well, we do want to avoid dying. My dad's 99 and I talk to him twice a week on Zoom. And the first thing I say is, Dad, how are you? And he goes, Megs, I'm on top of the grass. That's it. He's 99. He goes, I'm healthy. I'm on top of the grass. As long as I'm on top of the grass. And he is not interested in dying. You know, he was married to my mom for 72 years. I thought he will not go on without her. And he's like, she's still with me. So, you know, that's true. And I'll tell you, when I was a lawyer, it was hard to get people to do, you know, things like wills and stuff, because who wants to think about it, really? So that's what happened. So when we moved, we didn't have a lot of excess stuff. And I always try to, you know, make sure this stuff is repurposed or I give it away. That's another, you know, Facebook is evil, but one of the good things about Facebook, you know, is community. something. Facebook is evil. I will say that what's his face is evil. And I know I'm on his platform right now, but still. You know, the kind of community where people need stuff and you can get stuff to people. Mm-hmm. And I throw out almost nothing. I mean, unless it's total junk, in which case, you know, it's got to go to the dump. But if it still works, if it's still wearable, if it's still anything, it goes mm-hmm. to someone else or to somewhere else. And I don't sell it, like I give it away. So, you know, that's that. When we moved, it was pretty organized. But now I got here and I still have, and I thought, well, we don't have anything superfluous. And now I'm like, why do we still have this? I found a t-shirt. I found a t-shirt that's from, I used to produce parties for women in Connecticut under the moniker Out, O-U-T with an underline. That's how old, you know, it was, because it was before Out Magazine. Okay.
Wow. But do you remember when Out Magazine first began? That Out Magazine, which has become this glossy publication, for those of you who may not know, in the gay community, but when Out Magazine first began, their sole purpose was to out people that were not out, people who were had a political agenda that was anti-LGBTQ.
I did not know that, yeah. Richard.
Yes, absolutely. And I remember in the early 90s when Out Magazine first began, and thank God somebody went in a different direction with this.
But wow, if that is a fact, which I'm not doubting you, that mm-hmm. is a terrible way to start. That is just karmically horrible.
Absolutely. But it's a great magazine now. I love the magazine.
Well, yeah, well, I mean, but I did not know that was its origin. No, well, I called it Out because it seemed like the right thing, you know, and it was just a very black and white logo, white with black letters or black with white letters. And then and underneath it was a black bar and it said 112 Productions because my business partner and I had the same birthday. Mm-hmm. And when I was unpacking, I found a t-shirt from, because I keep sentimental t-shirts. Again, what's the point, right? I mean, but that t-shirt is, you know, I don't know how old it is, but it's 30 something years old, right?
And it means something to you. It's a symbol of a specific time in your life.
Yeah,
now,
yeah.
Now, normally, you know, with my interviews, I always like to go back to the 5-year-old self, but I'm going to go a little later.
I'm still here. I am the 5-year-old self. So
So am I. But you said that you, came out when you were 17 years old. Do you have brothers and sisters? What was the experience with your family as that was happening with you?
Well, without giving my age away, it was a long time ago. And I was outed. So first of all, I was raised Catholic. I was very Catholic. You know, so that kid was going to be a virgin until she's married kind of kid. And then I got a job at a movie theater. You know, taking tickets. And there was a lesbian there who, you know, they were all lesbians. I didn't know that. And, I found out, and of course I'm homophobic, right? Because I'm Catholic and, super gay. Clearly, you know, back then we called us tomboys. I think the correct term would have been non-binary. You know, but then it was tomboy because they don't know what to call you.
Right.
So this woman said to me, I said, well, I don't know any gay people. She goes, well, I'm gay. And I'm like, oh, and she's like, and I think you are too. And I was like, duh, 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 duh. You know, it's like, what?
Now, when she said that to you, that first time that you hear someone acknowledge that, what was that feeling like for you?
I can't remember it. I do remember it happening. Like I know where I was standing and I know where she was standing. She used to sell candy. Would you like a piece of candy, little girl? She used to sell candy. So she was behind the concession counter and I was standing on the other side. And you know what? She became my mentor and mentored me out of the closet. Ironically, and this is a great story. In 1993, I was performing at the March on Washington, the big.
I was there. Yeah.
So I was on that stage, you know, at the end of the march.
Were you on the same stage that Suede was on? Did you?
I, I was on the big stage at the back. I don't know if Suede was on that stage or the first stage. Okay. I was on the stage with RuPaul and with, you know, Cybill Shepherd and Irvashay Bade was there, and Kate Clinton and Leah Delaria and what's his name? Sir Ian McKellen. Look, those people were all on that stage. So I don't know how I got there, but I did. And I had my 5 minutes to do. And I did my 5 minutes. People are like, where's your interview? I'm like, stop texting me. I turned off my texting. I remember being on that stage at that time. And I'm digressing a bit. I remember telling my first joke and no one laughing. And thinking I'm gonna die. I'm literally gonna die, like on stage in front of a million people. Because I told
at this point, excuse me for interrupting, but at this point in your career, how long had you been performing?
About 4 or 5 years. I think I started in 88.
How did this specific gig or appearance come about for you?
I started doing comedy in 1988 when Leah Delaria saw me hosting as a lawyer a pride thing in Hartford, Connecticut. And she's like, you're funny, you're going to do stand-up. And I was like, okay.
And no one argues with Leah Delaria.
Exactly right. That's what I always say. You don't say no to Leah. So right. She's like, you're going to come to P-Town and be in my show. And so I went and did her show. And you're going to read from the news. Like, I mean, she even told me what I was, you know, what my shtick was.
And I'm going to interrupt again because I just want to fill in a few of the blanks here. You were a lawyer, and based on the research that I've done, when you started out, you didn't start out as a stand-up comedian. You were a sit-down comedian.
Yeah, I sat down forever.
You were just ranting and raving about what you were reading about in the newspaper.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think it was way before The Daily Show. It was, you know, certainly SNL had a desk bit. So I was basically doing a news desk bit. I used to say when The Daily Show came out, I was like, fuck. So I then put the tagline, The Daily Show on speed and estrogen, because I talk so fast. So Leah just said, this is what you're going to do. So I was a current events comic but from 1988. And it was fun to sit down. And then, you know, I would do some things. I would do some things that were... she also had me be in a sketch. So for the first time I performed, I did sketch comedy and stand up. And then she said, okay, now I'm going to come. We're going to put on a show in Hartford and you're going to produce it. So right from the beginning, I've been, you know, involved in the production. I've been involved I've written my own stuff, involved in producing and done sketch. So
now, were you always funny, or did you, or was it just the way that you filtered the world through your mind and through your eyes?
I don't know. You know, it's funny because I remember in high school, the guy who was the vice president of my class, like a dope dork, and Louis Chimes, who was vice president when I became a stand-up, was like, I don't get it. I was the funny one. I'm like, sorry, Lou. I mean, you know, you're a lawyer and now I'm not a lawyer anymore. So so I don't know that I thought I was funny. I never aspired to be funny. I did want to be an actor and I was afraid of that. So, you know, I every chance I had to go to acting, like I went to a fame school way back then. There was one in Connecticut called the Educational Center for the Arts. I had an opportunity to go into theater and I didn't. My first semester of school, I took a theater course, but I was waiting to go to Boston College to study English and philosophy. I went there. I didn't study acting. I wanted to do it, but I was afraid to fail. So then, you know, I taught for a year and then I went to law school, even though I wanted to perform, I was afraid to fail. So it was a circuitous route, and it was someone else who said, you should do this, that got me to do it. So
you,
I'm glad
I mean, most of us in our profession, we have that bug that takes over us. You didn't have that.
I had it. I was just afraid.
Oh, you were afraid. Okay.
I was afraid to fail at the thing that I wanted to do. So in my mind, if I didn't try, I couldn't fail at it. So
what's your name?
Leah just said, you're funny, you're going to do stand up. And that was it. Mm-hmm. You know, my grandfather, my father's father, you know, I have pictures of him dressed as one of the Three Musketeers, right? He was an actor. He was a stonemason and in theater. You know, my oldest brother, who is lost to the right at this point, but originally was a big theater geek, and, you know, long hair and capes and the whole bit. You know, another brother lost to the right, really talented and funny. And it does run in the family. My father's funny, and my mother was hilarious. So I think that, you know, it is absolutely something that's in the family. We're all performers. All of us are musical. Everybody plays the piano or something. But anyway, I digress. Back to the March on Washington. Mm-hmm. When I was, told my first joke and no one laughed, I remember another comic telling me before I went out, there's a 7-second sound delay. So as I was having my panic attack and I could feel the blood draining from everything, this big wave of laughter came back and I was like, oh, thank God. I did my 5 minutes, which were very political. And that person, this is how we get back to, isn't this crazy? And this is why ADD is not necessary. I call it attention surplus disorder, by the way. I don't have a deficit of attention. I'm paying attention. I'm just not paying attention to you. So circling all the way back, my mentor, who I thought would be proud of me, said you were an embarrassment. She was an accountant at that point, and I was embarrassed by you in front of my friends. And I was like, wow, really? And so apparently Frankenstein did not like the monster. Dr. Frankenstein, did not like her monster. So, and that's a hard hit to take when you're young and you're this person who you mentored you out of the closet then sort of says, you know, I made a mistake, I guess. Eventually get over it. But that's how I came out and that's how I got to performing. So, that woman, I think Connie Quackenbush is responsible for outing me and then for getting me out of the closet. And Leah Delaria is responsible for actually getting me on stage. So,
well, we thank both of them.
Yeah. I'm very grateful to both of them. And that's what brought me to being able to produce and perform and write all at once. And that's an advantage. I had never actually, been on a comedy club stage until a few years ago. Like, so that's another thing, right, Richard? Like comics, they want to be comics. They go to comedy clubs and they do their set of 3 minutes or 5 minutes and they wait and they try and get time and they want the best slot. I didn't know any of that because of Leah. And also because when I started doing comedy, Kate Clinton, Leah Delaria, those were the two out lesbian comics. Okay. Kate, Leah had been doing it since, I guess, the early 80s in San Francisco.
And Leah was the first on television.
Leah was
on Arsenio Hall that she made the appearance on, I think.
Yeah, I was there. I remember being in the green room and them telling the lawyer saying she couldn't say, it was a joke about, you know, first lady, I'd want a F, right? And she's like, we need a word. And I'm like, we came up with boink. Like, I just remember that panic of having to write another word for the F, for the F-bomb. And it was pretty cool. That was very cool. So Leah and Kate. So, like, honestly, people would throw money at you to say you were queer. They're like, you're gay? You're a comic? You'll say you're gay? Here's money. I mean, money. Like, you know, $500 was a lot of money for someone to pay you to do some stand-up, right? And to this day, it's actually a lot of money. You're not going to get it out of a comedy club if you're not a kind of a headliner comic. I mean, you get way more than that as a headliner, but it's just very, very interesting. And I had no knowledge of that until I became friends with the guy who owns a lot of the comedy clubs in Canada. And he was like, I don't know why you don't do my clubs. I'm like, it's not my thing. I don't even know how to do your club. And so he actually helped me because my delivery was very, very fast. People who came to see me knew how I spoke, knew what my delivery was, expected me. People would say, you do 2 hours of comedy in 1 hour. And trust me, I did. I didn't even wait for the laughs. I didn't care. You can laugh later. I got stuff to say, right? And the clubs in Provincetown, which is where I performed for, my God, since 1989 through until I stopped going there in probably 12 something, when it just became not, it just wasn't good anymore. Like the demographic of the changed town, the town changed, everything changed. And we can talk more about that later. But I was there for, 20 something years every single summer. But 50 minutes because they had to get that room out and get the next room in. Okay. And so it's, it was very, very, very crazy to have to cram all that material in. And because I was doing current events comedy, Richard, something would happen. You know what I mean? Something would happen. I'd be looking at my phone before I went in and I'm like, oh, I have to talk about that. You know, people expect me to talk about that. So I kept adding. I couldn't subtract because the material I was doing, I had just written. Every year I'd write a brand new show. And it would get better as the season went on because I had figured out the timing of the joke. So I'm not going to drop a joke to add a joke. So I just kept adding jokes and talking faster and talking faster and faster and faster and faster.
When you first started, we didn't have social media on the level that we have now, number one. you didn't have 24/7 newscast like we have now, to the extent that we do now. How has that affected or changed the way that you approach the work that you do on stage now, as opposed to when you first began in the business?
Has social media changed my work? Is that what the question is? Sorry, yes. I'm reading I'm reading some of the comments, and Kate Rigg is saying, technically, I'm a biracial bisexual, but if you want to fantasize about me as a lesbian, that's okay too. Did we mention Kate Rigg? I mean, Kate Rigg is one of my writing partners and an amazingly talented person. You may have seen her on Law and Order and shows like that and New Amsterdam. But she's amazing and she's a great writer. And
Kate Rigg. Thank you for joining.
So hello, Kate Rigg. Did I mention her because she's written this thing and apparently I mischaracterized her, but I don't remember talking about her. And that could just be hashtag menopause, hashtag weed. Anyway, to your question, it's changed. Look, I was always very careful. Having been a lawyer, people complain about, politically correct and you can't say anything anymore. You can say exactly what you want to say. You can always say what you want to say, but there's consequences to what you say. And now people can actually get your stuff out to more people and get you in bigger trouble than the woman who came up to me after the show and got mad at me because I used to do this bit about UPC codes and I would take a loaf of Wonder Bread and squish it. I would be like, by the time she's done, because the lady couldn't get the thing on it, the bread was just like this little ball. And, someone actually came up to me after and was like, you realize that you're wasting food and right. And gave me shit for wasting the loaf of bread. Mm-hmm. And I was like, okay, I hear what you're saying. And then she's like, are you going to take it out of your show? And I'm like, no, but I will make a donation to a food bank because that's, you make a legitimate, this, that I'm wasting a loaf of bread. So it's, but
well,
today,
let me ask you, have you done the college circuit with your comedy? And how has that changed for you?
Well, I did then. I don't do it now. I don't actually have an agent who handles me for stand-up. But back then when I did the college circuit, it was, it was a lot of money and they weren't paying. So I never really thought the college audience was my favorite audience because they didn't really care. They're like, it's free and we're going. And, the queer kids were like into it because it was like, it was a long time ago and you were a queer. Right. Mm-hmm. So as to social media now, it's helpful in that, you hand out flyers on the street in Provincetown to get people to come to your show. And you kind of still have to do that. It's the only place. And I think Edinburgh, right, for the Edinburgh Festival, things like fringe festivals. But it helps you in promoting. It can hurt you if people decide they want to go and say what you said was bad. But again, having been a lawyer, I never said anything in court that I didn't know what the possibilities of what would come back at me were. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Because that was the only way I could zealously represent my client. Don't ask a question you don't know the answer to. Very old legal adage. Okay. Right. So if I was going to tell a joke and it was going to be political, which they all were, in my brain, I had to know what the complaints were going to be about that joke. Who was going to come back to me and say this, that, or the other thing? Usually, because I'm not a mean-spirited person, it was going to be someone from the other side that I actually probably didn't give a shit about. But if it was on the line, the way I delivered that joke would be, I know a lot of people say this, and I get that, and I appreciate that. But so acknowledging what the sort of acknowledging what the complaint would be, or, you know, acknowledging that people have different opinions than you first, even as a throwaway line, does engage people and let you know that, you know, you hear them and you see them and you don't, maybe don't agree with them. But, you know, I mean, that's, other than that, I mean, if you're not a mean-spirited person and someone calls you on something, then you know what, they're just that, they're the finger waggers who I was when I was in university. And I was the one who ruined Thanksgiving because I was a radical lesbian feminist separatist, because I went to a Catholic school and studied with Mary Daly, who was the, you know, radical lesbian separatist theologian, and, you know, made me open my eyes to so much. And yes, I mean, that's, and I went right for that. And it didn't work for me because I'm also a people person. I lived in a co-ed dorm and I'd leave class and I was like, patriarchy, men are evil. And then some guy would walk by and go, hi, Maggie. I'd be like, hi, Bob. I mean, pig. Oh, you know, I liked Bob.
Right.
So, you know, so I was, I even though I can't, I don't, you know, a lot of people are like, oh, the people who are always correcting you and all of that stuff. I was that person. So what am I going to do? Am I going to say, God, you're a pain in the ass? Well, basically I'd be looking at younger me saying, God, you're a pain in the ass, which I was, but you have a right to be a pain in the ass when you're first coming to terms with your brains and the world. I think they call it woke now. I called it sort of just became aware of the world, right?
Well, going back to your, I mean, you were an attorney, and were you doing the comedy as at the same time that you were doing the work as a lawyer, or were they two separate acts in your life?
No, they were not separate, which was very, which was okay for the most part, except one day I was in court. At the same time, I also owned a club. So while I was a lawyer and I became a stand-up, I bought a club down the street and opened up because I was having these lesbian parties every month. And I mean, I had 735 women at one party. And that sounds like not a lot now, but understand the bar was this big, you know. I mean, it had three floors, so we weren't over capacity ever. But we turned over that many people one night. It was like open a bar, open a bar, open a bar. And I did. And of course it snowed every weekend. No one came. And I was, you know, I lost my shirt in 6 months, but I was in court one day, and then that was the same time. This is the other thing, Richard, you know, sometimes we are self-oppressed. I was the only out lesbian lawyer at that time, besides Shirley Pripstein, who worked for Legal Aid. And I was, you know, it was during the AIDS plague. It was, I had trans clients in the early 90s. All my gay guy clients who had AIDS were dying like within 6 months of when they were diagnosed. It was a brutally, brutally hard time, but also a brutally important time. We tried to test case for gay adoption. I had two clients who were scientists at Pfizer, and they were like, we're doing this, and that's the thing, you know, they came to me and said, will you take this case? And certain organizations, queer organizations, were like, no, you shouldn't do it. We're not ready. And my clients were like, we don't care what they say or what anyone says. We're ready and we want you to do this. And if you don't do it, someone else will do it. So, you know, bless their little pointy, nerdy scientist heads, because their case changed the law for, you know, second parent adoption in Connecticut, right? But at that time, because I was the only out lesbian, I was like, I gotta look like not a lesbian. I mean, it sounds so messed up, long blonde hair, always in heels, always in skirts, you know, dressed to the nines. And I looked around one day, Richard, and nobody, all the women were wearing pants but me. And I was like, asshole, sorry, that's the first time I swore, but
okay.
why are you doing this? You know, it's the buildings in Connecticut, the heat was, you know, they're literally from like the 1800s or whatever. They're all marble. The heat's always on. It's 90 degrees in the middle of the summer. You're wearing pantyhose. You just don't want to know what's happening like with that scenario. It's terrible. And I thought, well, this is stupid. And I went, well, if I'm going to wear pants, I'm going to wear a suit. And I went out and got myself a men's suit and I tailored it. I had it tailored to fit me. And I got myself some wingtips and a lovely tie. Then I went to court in my long blonde hair, basically in drag. And everybody was like, oh my God, that suit, where'd you get that suit? You look amazing. That's amazing. That's amazing. That's amazing. And it, which surprised me. I had one judge who's passed, who I adored, a criminal court judge, who was like, you know, complimented me on my suit, my shoes, because I had on like spectator Oxfords, like the men's shoes, but black and white. And he was like, he wore those shoes all the time. But here's the point. I'm in another court and I'm in a suit and I had never been before this judge. And there were about two female black judges in Connecticut at that time. And she was one of them. And she was also diminutive. She was a very teeny little, but to me, she was like as big as the world, right? So she's behind the bench and she's like, this was a very simple thing. All I had to do, Richard, was put it on the record. I had a deal. All I had to do was put it on the record. We done. And she goes, Attorney Casella, will you please approach the bench? And I'm like, oh my God, I'm screwed. I'm in trouble. I've never had to approach the bench. What have I done? It's the suit. She's going to say, don't ever come into my court dressed like that ever again. You know, so I walked up to the bench, which was like 8 steps. It felt like 400 years. It was like clunk, clunk. Anyway, I got up there. I'm like, yes, Your Honor. And she's like, I hear you're a stand-up comic. Please write down where you're performing. And I hear you're a stand-up comic in Cape Cod. Please write down where you're performing because my husband and I are going up there and we'd like to see you. And I was like, oh my God.
You bring up a very interesting point, though. And I want to, because one of the biggest issues that I deal with going through life is projecting. When I project that what I think someone else is going to say, what I think they're going to do, and 9 times out of 10, I'm proven wrong. Nine times out of 10. And here is a perfect example of you saying that.
Well, I'm Italian. I was raised in a Jewish neighborhood. I always say I'm an Italian Jew. As it turned out, we had my mom do a I say don't ever do a DNA test. Why would you give the government or anyone your DNA? But if you have your 90-something-year-old parents spit in a cup, that's fine. Mm-hmm. So my brother did that. And my mom turned out to be like 20-something% Ashkenazi. So I actually am a little Jewish. So Italian Jew fits. It's a lot of guilt. There's a lot of guilt in that. And there's a lot of guilt in Catholicism. There's a lot of guilt in you know, Jewish culture for sure. Even my next door neighbor was like my second mom and I would feel guilty if I didn't please her. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think that kind of projection is it's gotta be me. I must've done something wrong. Like that's my projection. Like, what have I done? I try to run that scenario through my head first now, as I'm older and, think, maybe what's happening with them, what's their day like, what's going on with them. And part of that is also, you know, lawyering helped that too. You know, you never know the kind of day people are having. You never know, you know, what people are going through, who has cancer in their family, who has, you know, just lost someone, who's, you know, can't pay the bills, who, whatever, what kind of stress is going on. And, you know, we all,
But do you think that, you know, as part of our community, that this is something that we take on as another layer in terms of trying, for the most part in our lives, you know, I think, you know, based on everything that I'm seeing and hearing, that you're very comfortable in your skin now. And of course, that's a process. It was a process for me. I'm very comfortable in my skin. I know who I am. I know what I am, and I know where I am when I walk into any place. And that comes with life experiences. I want to ask you before, you know, we run out of time, when was the deciding factor when you shut the chapter on your career as an attorney and just went into this business full throttle. As I said earlier, you are a juggler because you've got your hands in so many pots. And based on what I'm seeing, I don't see the failures, but I see so many things that you that you have done that are incredibly successful.
Thank you. And Jenny Wall says, this is a good thing to discuss. Thank you to hear what she's saying. But if she meant about projecting, then okay, that's, yes. I'm glad that we talked about that. I actually met a girl, you know, I mean, a lot of people, and this is in my stand-up, say, you know, you're so smart, you got out of the States, you're so smart, you got out. And my joke is, you know, I'd like to take credit for being some kind of, you know, political Nostradamus who 20-something years ago put my hand in my chin and went, U.S. is going to go to hell in a handbasket. I'm out of here.
and it did.
You know, yeah, but that's not what happened. It was a girl. I mean, I always say not smart, just, you know, shiny lady. That was, you know, she was like, move to Canada, you know, and I did. And because I was a lawyer and a comedian, I got a lot of work on TV right away as a talking head, CBC, you know, news. I mean, I was debating Ralph Nader and former prime ministers and, you know, premiers and mayors and, you know, at the same table with all these people. And it was fun. And I got a certain amount of attention for that. And then, you know, as time went on, and the girl I moved for dumped me, and I was like, uh-oh, now do I go back to the States? Do I continue to be a lawyer? What do I do? I did actually get the materials to take the bar in Canada. But because I was getting the work, I started getting enough work so I didn't actually have to. So that was the tipping point was I came here.
And then
first of all, in the beginning, if you said, do you miss it? I would have been like, but, and then there was a time when I didn't miss it, but I felt like I could be doing this and not relying on someone else to do it, or I could be helping this person, but I'm not. But no, being a lawyer is not a profession that is, it's not well regarded anymore. It's not, it's just, it's not like there's a lot of money in it. Mm-hmm. I never made a lot of money doing it because I gave my time away a lot. So that was it. It was the move to Canada that tripped it. And then lucky me falling into being able to get work. And the reason I do all the things I do now is, and always have, is, you know, my agent would say I'm frenetic and she's right. But really what I do is I go to the project that will pay me. A lot of my colleagues, when I had my own talk show, my whole department was walked out of the building when the station was acquired by another business. So they closed my whole station closed. Mm-hmm. I left right before then, but right after that, we were called Star. It was an entertainment network. It was like a Canadian version of E. They just were like, we don't need you. We already have that. So everybody got walked out of the building. Like, I can't tell you how many of my colleagues are realtors, not that there's anything wrong with that, or, you know, are onto different things that aren't in the business. And those are producers and writers and performers. And, you know, my wife has a proper job. So credit where credit is due. I haven't had to do that. But B, because Leah taught me how to produce, I actually have been producing constantly. So luckily this year in the middle of COVID, I sold the show to the CPC, which was the We're Funny That Way special. And you know what? I actually gave myself an attagirl for that. And I never do that. Yeah. You know, my producing partner, Ann Barnsley, basically said, hey, you know, we just sold the show at COVID. You know, my business partner, Katie Ford, was like, yeah, we did. And so that was kind of like, I have to stop and say that's an accomplishment, you know? And then we did our first short this year. We finished it and entered it into a bunch of, you know, festivals. It got 13 laurels on it. But you know, am I in front of a camera? No. I am on that, but yeah, I am. But am I auditioning? Am I getting parts on TV? No. I got cast as the veterinarian on Clifford the Big Red Dog this year. So mm-hmm. That was good. You know, Right. But those things, you know, those are a few things, and that's good. And if my wife wasn't having a proper job, I might be selling real estate or doing some other thing. But that is why I do all of the things that I do, so that I can make money, because there is no stand-up right now. And in the beginning, people were doing Zoom stand-ups and people were tipping and you could make money. But, you know, that market got saturated very quickly.
Well, I want to ask you, if Leah Delaria had not come along in your life, do you feel that you still would have pursued this business?
I say that again, because the whole thing dropped.
You froze for just a moment.
Okay.
But if Leah Delaria had not come along in your life, if this is all speculation, I know, do you think that you would have pursued this?
I think, you know what, the bug was in me enough. I don't know that I would have done stand-up ever. Mm-hmm. I don't know how I could not have written something. You know, the ideas that are in my head all the time are so frequent that it's kind of maddening at times, right? Sometimes I can't even get enough of it on paper, and I can't, you know, and that's another issue, right? You got to finish one thing before you start another, but you get another idea. So I don't really know. I don't know. I think that given that, like you said, it's in you have the bug in you. It might have found its way out. I was very, very lucky that Leah decided, that to help me along, or to, and she's done that for other people. And so I try to do that for other people as well. You know, if I see somebody or somebody needs help, or with We're Funny That Way, which is a charity event, I try to, you know, find new talent that, you know, I had one guy a couple of years ago, Larry Johnson, who I just saw some stupid videos he did on YouTube, and I'm like, this guy's hilarious, right? And I don't think he'd ever done a full show. And it was like, come up here and do a full show. And now he's all over the place. But I think just being able to say, oh, I recognize that talent, and I would love to, instead of being afraid of that talent, because Richard, you know this, the only other way to go is jealousy. And why isn't it me? Or, you know what, a lot of people do that, right? So my thing is if you make me uncomfortable, if I watch you and I'm uncomfortable watching you because you're that good, I want you on my show because I think you're better than I am. Mm-hmm. So I could take, I think you're better than I am, and go and make something up and say why I don't like you. Or I could embrace that. Mm-hmm. And plus, we're not all alike. I mean, I'm me, and there's very, you know.
You know, I get up each day and I go, okay, get in your lane, put your blinders on, do the best job that you can do, and be the best Richard Skipper that I can possibly be. That's all I have. There are a lot of people out there who are doing the same platform that we're doing this on right now.
Yep.
Some are better. Some are worse. Some don't know what they're doing. Some do it better. But nobody can do what I do. Nobody.
Right.
I bring myself to the table. And it's the same thing with you. I mean, there's a comment here from Jennifer Walls, and she said, you do so many wonderful things for other people. And there are two points that I want to point on with this. And you know this, obviously, with everything you, and I love the fact that you give credit where it's due. Nobody gets through this alone. It's the people that you meet along the way.
Yeah.
It's what they bring to the table. It's what you bring to the table. You obviously are very proactive in your career. When did that begin to happen for you, where you just took the reins and took off?
Well, let me just start by saying Jenny Walls is one of the most talented people you'll ever meet. She's a singer and a director and is seriously crazy talented. When you're done, go on YouTube and find Jenny Walls doing every single voice of everyone on the spinning wheel. Leah and I are still, you know, BFFs to this day, and we drive each other crazy, and we're constantly, you know, we write together with Kate Rigg, and, you know, we've had our knockdown dragouts, and I don't want to give her credit for everything, but I was fortunate again to go back to saying at the beginning, Leah said, we're going to produce us in Hartford, and learning production, as you know, makes it crazy different. Because I'm not waiting around. You're not waiting around. You go and you get people, you do your research, you do your interviews, and you have your platform. I knew, you know, no one was going to give me work. I mean, they did in the beginning, but then eventually it's like, you can wait around to get work, but if you wait around to get work, you're not going to have work. So because I had that production talent right away, I was constantly, you know, being proactive and constantly going, okay, well, I haven't done a show in a while. I need to do a show. I'm going to call someone in Albany. So like one year, you know, before Leah got on Orange and we would do shows together. Mm-hmm. I called someone in Albany, in Rochester, in Buffalo, in New Haven, and in Hartford. And we got in a car with Jeanette Mason, also an amazing jazz pianist, who was the musical director at the time. And we drove. You know, I think they came to Toronto and we went Buffalo, Albany, Hartford, New Haven, and then P-Town, I think. Mm-hmm. Or maybe not. That was a different tour. But nobody booked that tour for us. I booked that tour for us. Right. That was how it went. I just called places and you know what? Decent money. You know, is it fun driving everywhere? Actually, no, kind I, of. Well, you know, no, I,
it's, it, you know, be, I love being on the road, you know, and hopefully when this all gets behind us, you know, that will come back sooner rather than later.
Well, I mean, yes. And not to cut you off, but Leah lost her cell phone between one stop and another stop. And we were looking everywhere. We went, drove all the way back to the Starbucks. And like, I mean, and then, you know, it turned out she was sitting on it. It was between the seats. So of course there were more jokes on that than we could even, you know, your cell phone's up your ass delivery.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, and then another time, you know, there's just stories. I mean, Emmett Cohen.
I can only imagine what that car trip was like.
Oh, please. And then one time when it was me and Leah and Emmett Cohen is one of the finest jazz pianists in the world right now. He was playing with us and we were driving from New Haven to P-Town. It was like 2 a.m. I was falling asleep. Leah didn't have her license with her, so she couldn't drive. Emmett was 20, barely 20 something. And I'm like, Emmett, you have to drive. But at the time he was, you know, he lived in New York. He's a New Yorker. So he wasn't like the best driver. And I was like, I can't fall asleep. And there was a car that was on fire on the side of the road. And it was 2 a.m. and we were on a 5-lane highway and he stopped. I'm like, why are you stopping? Why are you stopping? Right. So we pulled over and then I slapped myself, you know, all the way to P-Town. So yeah, I mean, there's a million stories about being on the road and they're fun. Some of them are deadly or dangerous. I mean, almost deadly and dangerous, but I do, you know, you can't turn back time. I mean, I don't know what everything's going to look like. Is anything going to be around when we get back, Richard? You know,
Who knows?
I moved to the country. You know, I'm ready to pull I used to own a club and it burned down and I'm Italian and I was in Florida at the time. So everyone thinks I torched it, but I didn't. You know,
that's on the record here, folks.
Yeah, but when this is done, like, do I have the bug to do another venue? You know what? If I could make it a theater and a listening room, my friend Molly Johnson, who's another amazing jazz singer, moved out to this area. I would grab Molly and make a listening room and bring live, you know, jazz and comedy and entertainment, cabaret out to here in the middle of nowhere where people appreciate it just as much as people do in the city. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I mean, but who knows? Like, this is a weird world we live in. I'm talking to you.
But you make it so much better. I can't believe this, but we are at the end of our show almost.
That was easy.
You know, I told you, we just sit down and we talk. And I mean, I could go on forever with you. I feel like I've known you for 100 years.
Yeah, and I feel like we've met, but we haven't.
Yes,
right?
It feels that way. I want to give a big shout out to Rosa Puzo, who is a big supporter of mine, and she makes my life a whole lot better. And she suggested this interview, and I'm so grateful for it. I want to thank everyone for being here today. If you enjoyed the show, and I hope you did, please go to my website, which is richardskipper.com, and put your thoughts about the show, because that helps to boost me and other markets. And I want to let everyone know I'm doing a very special show tomorrow afternoon with one of my favorite people in the business, and that's Dale Shores. And it's his birthday tomorrow.
Oh, I love Dale Shores. Yay.
Oh, Sorted Lives, Southern Baptist Sissies.
Sorted, yes.
From the moment that I saw Sorted Lives, I've been in love with him. I've interviewed him before. And I just reached out and I said, are you available on the 3rd to do this interview? And he said, Richard, that's my birthday. I'd love to do it. So come back to at 3 o'clock and we'll celebrate him. I always end every show. Well, thank you. I always end every show by asking everyone to go out and do something nice for somebody else without expecting anything in return. Go to your Facebook friends list. Go to the second name that pops up and reach out to that person and say, I'm just reaching out to let you know what you mean to me. Not a text, not an email, but an actual phone call. And before we sign off, Maggie, again, thank you for the gifts that you've given to the world and that you will continue to give to the world. I'm going to give you the final word. Anything you want to say to expound upon anything that we've discussed today that you want to build upon, anything that we didn't talk about that you wish that we had, or just any message that you want to put out to the world at this time. It's your platform. And again, thank you for all you do. And I am a huge fan. Thank you. Well,
thank you. I actually am just very grateful to have done this interview. I mean, it was something to put on some makeup and do my hair and all of that stuff. My COVID hair, which is humongous. But I'm with you, Richard. I mean, I think that as my friend Darnett says, it's all about our ripple in the world. So it's a little drip, and the little drip makes a ripple. And I'm all about during this time reaching out to people just to say hi, you know, in any way, shape or form, just letting them know that you're there in case they need you. And some and even a person you haven't spoken to in a really long time. I'm trying to do that. I will just say this last thing. There was David Rakoff, this amazing author who passed away. After he died, I read his little obit in the New York Times, the Sunday magazine, the people we've lost this year. And what somebody said about David is he was one of those people who, you know, would just send you the sweetest little note to let you know that he was thinking of you and, you know, and how it could change your day. And interestingly enough, I had interviewed him a couple times, and a few months before that, he wrote me and said, I just remembered this crazy woman with this amazing energy. This great interview I did in the bookstore in Toronto, and I wanted to say, you know, hi. And I said, David, oh my God, I'm just such a huge fan. If you come back to Toronto, can we have a cup of coffee? And he said, yeah, absolutely. And you know what, Richard, he was dying, and he knew he was dying. And the fact that he took, you know, the time to send me that note, man, I mean, I'm so sorry, but
no,
I'll never forget that, right? And I think that's what we can do for people, no matter who we are, no matter what we do, you know, just take the time to reach out and change somebody's, maybe the trajectory or of their day and maybe their everything. So, yeah, so I'm with you. And
thank
David,
you, so much.
You know, rest his soul, or thank you. Maybe it's shit disturbing.
Yes. Well, thank you so much. Happy holidays. I hope that your new home is everything you want it to be and beyond. And I want everyone to go out and do something nice, as I just said, and make it a better tomorrow. We're all in this together, but we're just not the same boat. Have a great day. Thank you.